From WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When America began its war on terror, President Bush told the world, you're either with us or against us. Now, with war on Iraq looming, the administration's mantra just might be, you're with us or who cares? Speaking to Marines at Camp Pendleton on Tuesday, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld made it crystal clear that America doesn't need support from its allies if it decides to take military action against Iraq to topple Saddam Hussein.
In unanimity, we often find an absence of rigorous thinking. And it's more important, it's less important to have unanimity than it is to be making the right decisions and doing the right thing. Even though, at the outset, it may seem lonesome.
This afternoon, Vice President Dick Cheney said Washington will consult allies, but Bush administration minds sound made up. Forget what Germany, France, Canada, Saudi Arabia, even what our best friend the British think. America, the unilateral, will go it alone if necessary. What do you make of this Lone Ranger approach? Is it moral strength or arrogance? Is it any way to fight a war in the 21st century? What do we know that our allies don't? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight from Bath, England, is historian and journalist Jeffrey Wheatcroft. His essay, An Uncertain Ally on Iraq, is in today's New York Times. Good evening and welcome, Jeffrey Wheatcroft.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. And with me in the studio, I'm delighted to say, is Joseph Nye, Dean of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, a senior defense and intelligence official in the Clinton administration, and author of the new book, The Paradox of American Power, Why the World's Only Superpower Can't Go It Alone. Good evening and welcome in studio, Joe Nye.
Nice to be with you.
Good to have you. With us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
Jeffrey Wheatcroft, let me jump in with you. I know it's late there in the UK. You write today that the United States should not count on Britain coming into a war against Iraq, despite what we've heard from Tony Blair. Why do you say so?
Well, there are two points, really. One, first of all, without being too unkind about our prime minister, he does have a very pronounced tendency to tell any given audience what it wants to hear. And in this case, he has said, presumably, privately, to President Bush, that the Americans can rely on British support, as they received. We were allies in the Gulf War to go no further back, and then.
So can we or can't we?
In the campaign on Afghanistan, well, only a couple of weeks ago, Blair then told King Abdullah of Jordan that he had grave misgivings about a war on Iraq. So I think one has to be careful of taking anything he says. Absolutely at face value. The other point is that I'm not sure that he can carry this country into such a campaign, a war against Iraq. The opinion polls are quite strongly against it. Interestingly enough, conservative voters as well as Labour voters, the backbenchers of the Labour Party are quite strongly against a war with Iraq.
Are you suggesting, Jeffrey Wheatcroft, that if Tony Blair pushes for the UK to join that war at the side of the US, he might be pushed out of the Prime Minister's seat?
Well, it's not inconceivable. I mean, you know, the Prime Minister under our constitutional arrangement, we don't have a written constitution, but he does not have tenure.
Mm-hmm.
The Prime Minister is simply, by definition, the person who at any given moment can command a majority in the House of Commons, and people have been ejected very often by the House of Commons. But, I mean, I don't say this is likely to happen immediately. What I think is much more likely to happen is that if Blair thinks that there is a chance of his being unable to carry his own party and Parliament, and even his cabinet with him, he will back off.
Jeffrey Wheatcroft, what is driving British public opinion against war with Iraq? What's your interpretation?
Well, I don't think anything is exactly driving it. There is a general disinclination here to go into this particular war. After September the 11th, one of the most striking, and I would say one of the saddest things, is the way that the sympathy for America after September the 11th has been dissipated. At that time, when Tony Blair said that we would go in with the Americans to try and root out Al-Qaeda from Afghanistan, there was, of course, dissenting voices then. But on the whole, there was a general sense here that that was the right thing to be done. After all, the United States had been savagely attacked on September the 11th. But there is here a general sense that people don't really see what the rationale is for this war against Iraq, and they have, and even the government itself has now been saying, has now been leaking to people like Richard Holbrooke, that the Bush administration has completely failed to explain the necessity of this war against Iraq.
And that sentiment seems to go not just in the UK, but right across Europe today. French President Jacques Chirac condemned U.S. threats to attack Iraq unilaterally, saying that a United Nations mandate should be sought for military action. Is this Europe and maybe now the UK seeing the United States turning toward a high-handed foreign policy? Is this Europe wanting not to be dragged into war, or an accumulation of grievance over American superpower?
Well, there is, of course, a resentment against, the people in the White House and the Pentagon will say that this is just European envy and resentment because the United States has taken over from the historic role of the West European powers as the imperial dominant global superpowers of 100 years ago or less, and that, in some senses, that's perfectly true. There are all sorts of different forms of grievance and resentment. I don't have to explain that the French have a deep-rooted antipathy towards America, at any rate, American foreign policy. But on this particular issue, it goes further than that. It goes further than the pervasive cafe intellectual distaste for all things American that you can still find in Paris. The French, in fact, have been slightly less, despite today, the French have, if anything, been rather less than usually vehement in their condemnation of America. But you've got in Germany, you have Schröder running for re-election as chancellor on a specific platform, saying that Germany will have nothing to do with the war against Iraq. Now, there is no country on the European continent which openly supports such a war and has said that it will take part in it. And that leaves England, which until the last few weeks or few days appeared, thanks to the impression that Tony Blair had given, to be supportive of the United States yet again. But Blair is inevitably backing off this because he is not Saddam Hussein. He has to take account of public opinion and political opinion.
I want to bring Joe Nye into this conversation. Joe Nye, you've got a big thesis on the entire issue of power in the world and how it's accumulated and kept and exercised today, the importance of acting in concert with others. But let's take this narrow issue first because it's so striking of the UK and Europe. If Geoffrey Wheatcroft is correct, if it's conceivable that even the United Kingdom might not stand alongside the U.S. in an attack on Iraq, how much does that matter in a world where all the rest of Europe effectively has already said it won't?
Well, I think I agree with Geoffrey Wheatcroft. I think it is really quite extraordinary that a year ago there was enormous sympathy for the United States, and most of that's dissipated. And partly it's the way the Bush administration has explained its policies. For example, after we won militarily in Afghanistan in December, the president said the Geneva Conventions don't matter. Well, he had to retract that, but it cost us in the meantime. Similarly, we didn't want to join the International Criminal Court, but then we wound up in this silly campaign of attacking it, of trying to undercut it, of competing with the Europeans for favor on this. So we've dissipated the goodwill we had so that somebody like Tony Blair, who Bush is going to want to have support him on Iraq, is undercut at home by the actions of the American administration of going it alone, of paying no attention to the opinions of others.
And now we're effectively on the runway to war, despite the Bush administration's assurances that it will consult with Congress. There'll be hearings coming up. There'll be consultations with the European allies. Dick Cheney's been banging the drum this week, more forcefully perhaps than ever, saying we must do this. He said today that Iraq is a mortal danger to the United States. And we don't have that international support. Are we in a perilous position, or can we somehow uniquely afford to go it alone in a war of this scale, Joe Nye?
Well, militarily, it's going to be a lot more difficult and a lot more expensive if we have to go it alone. And politically, it's going to cost us a lot more as well. I think the thing that's interesting is in the last month, there's been what I would call the counterattack from the Republican moderates.
Mm-hmm.
Inside the administration, you have the traditional Republicans like Colin Powell, Brent Scowcroft, Larry Eagleburger, James Baker, former Secretaries of State for Bush's father. who have now begun to say, you know, we're worried. And they've counterattacked against what you might call the neoconservative Republicans, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Wolfowitz, and so forth. Mm-hmm. In fact, there are more differences between the neoconservative Republicans and the traditional Republicans than between Republicans and Democrats. And the interesting question is, after the op-eds and television appearances by Senator Hagel, the Senate, and
raising his own questions,
Scowcroft, Baker, and so forth, Cheney and Rumsfeld have counterattacked, and I think the open question is, where's the president on this?
So he's straddling more than the rest, but it's not easy to straddle forever when your Secretary of Defense and your own vice president are speaking up so forcefully. Jeffrey Wheatcroft, the Secretary of Defense in the U.S., Donald Rumsfeld, suggested this week that the United States might indeed have to go it alone, but that if it was correct in its analysis, and that if it went alone, the rest of the world, or at least key allies, would eventually swing in behind it. Do you see that as the likely path ahead if the U.S., at least at the outset, goes after Iraq alone? If it's relatively successful, can we expect that Europeans will eat their words and one way or another fall in behind?
No, I don't think you can expect that. I would say that that if the United States does take military action without any allies at all, then whatever the outcome, and people are very apprehensive here, I mean, whatever the outcome, it will only widen the gulf between America and Europe, which I increasingly think is one of the most important and interesting political episodes of the age we live in. I mean, we've heard a great deal about the clash of civilizations, mm-hmm. which is usually taken to mean the West and the East, or Christendom and Islam. But the clash of civilizations between America and Europe is not widely enough examined, and I think it's going to play a very important part in this. And I don't think that simply, even if they were managed to topple Saddam Hussein, and there's also here a very strong sense of apprehension about what exactly this military operation is going to be, how it's going to be carried out, where its bases are going to be, if the Americans don't have any
some big
allies
questions
in the region at all. Mm. And even if Saddam Hussein is deposed, what comes next in Iraq, and what the likely consequences are to be in the region.
Jack Beatty, I want you to join us here for a moment. We had Jeffrey Wheatcroft on in springtime talking about this potential clash of civilizations between the United States and Europe. That was kind of conceptual. Now we've got a war sitting in front of us that could be a real turning point, a real watershed.
Yes, it could be. And it's interesting to compare this episode with the last time the United States was ready to take preemptive action against a country that had weapons of mass destruction threatening us. And that was the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962. What did President Kennedy do? First thing he did was dispatch his Secretary of State to the Organization of American States to get them on board for a hard line toward Cuba. Very important, because, of course, otherwise it would look like Yankee imperialism. Mm. What is President Bush doing? Ignoring what the neighboring states are saying. Second thing he did, he sent his U.N. ambassador, Adlai Stevenson, to the U.N. to show proof, actually show photographs of the mission, of the missiles. Mm-hmm. And we now know that those missiles were nuclear armed. The third thing he did was reject the call of his military advisors for a strike and said, no, we're going to take the middle course, a blockade, an act of war against Cuba, but not the Soviet Union. And he was partly moved by this by his summer reading. He had been reading The Guns of August, Barbara Tuchman's book about how the powers in 1914 blundered into war, sort of like a kind of a nightmare scenario where they just sort of one misunderstood the other, and sure enough, they had a world war on their hands. And what is and he said to one of his advisors, I don't want to be the man who starts World War III, as these generals and statesmen of 1914 started the cataclysm.
But this time there's no Soviet Union, and maybe there's another view.
And what is President Bush reading? He's reading a book called Supreme Command that says, don't pay attention, politician, to those military men who say, maybe we should be cautious.
It's a new world, and we're standing tall, maybe alone in it. Jeffrey Wheatcroft, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Jeffrey Wheatcroft is British journalist and author of today's op-ed piece in the New York Times, An Uncertain Ally on Iraq. We're talking about America the Unilateral. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America, the unilateral, making war, maybe making war alone. Our guest in studio tonight is Joseph Nye, author of The Paradox of American Power, Why the World's Only Superpower Can't Go It Alone. What do you think? Do you think the United States should go it alone in Iraq, in the world? If the whole world says no to war with Iraq, does it matter? Should we jump in anyway? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joe Nye, what's your sense of this war as a potential turning point? We've talked about the path that the U.S. relations with Europe and the rest of the world have taken since 9/11, about the diminished sense of solidarity, even sympathy, as Washington has stepped ahead. Is it possible, after the Gulf War, the world essentially resumed a form that we well knew? Is it possible that if the United States pushes into this war without that kind of coalition, without buy-in from important global allies, that we could see a new world on the other side? Or are our nations likely to line up behind us if we succeed anyway?
I think that it depends on how it's done. I actually think that if we had good proof that Saddam Hussein is developing a nuclear weapon, that would be grounds for going ahead and using force. After all, he violated his own multilateral obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, mm-hmm. violated UN sanctions. But unlike the neoconservative Republicans in the administration who are saying, go right now and don't worry about the rest, makes a huge difference whether we, in fact, lay the groundwork so that we bring others along with us. We should get the UN inspectors back in there, not because they're going to find the weapons, but because it's going to prove that Saddam is cheating. And at that point, we're going to have a much better chance of getting the support we need. If you look at the opinion that was in yesterday's New York Times from Karl Kaiser, a very distinguished, very pro-American German analyst, head of the German Society of International Relations, said, in democracies in Europe today, you just cannot ignore the UN. We ought to go through the necessary steps to make sure that we have support. And I think the big mistake is to skip those steps.
But you see what's actually happening. We have an administration official saying we don't need more inspections. It's time for regime change, with or without them. Clearly, Dick Cheney, in the tone and tempo of his remarks this week, is not saying we won't act until we have clear evidence of nuclear weapons. So the prospect of war without these kind of ameliorating steps in the interim that you describe seems real to me. I wonder what you think. And if that should happen, what do we risk in terms of our relationships, not with Baghdad, but with the rest of the world?
I think it would be severely damaging to our relations with the rest of the world if we didn't take these steps. It's interesting if you look at David Sanger's piece in the front page of the New York Times today. He says essentially that the president has decided that he will go to Congress, but that there's an internal debate going on about whether you do these UN steps or not.
Mm-hmm.
Last Sunday, former Secretary of State James Baker said,
do
you
it.
Must do these steps going through the UN.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there was a counterattack from Cheney and Rumsfeld saying, no, don't get caught in the UN trap. It's a snare and a delusion. And so you can see the battle. I mean, for an administration which is very good at keeping all these internal differences mm-hmm. quiet in its first year,
very unusual.
They're now coming right out in the open.
We want to listen very closely to your analysis of this because you've been on the inside in the Clinton administration. And what I'm hearing you say is you're really not sure which way George Bush will ultimately go.
I think it's still an open question. I mean, I think the president has to make sure that he is doing the right thing. And he's listening to advisors on both sides. I don't think he's made up his mind on it yet.
Listeners, what do you think? We're talking about America, the unilateral tonight. Do you want the U.S. standing tall, acting on its own hunch? Or do you want a U.S. that acts in union with partners? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Eric is on the line. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
And I would pose the following scenario. First, I would like to state that I'm 100% in favor of a preemptive attack, and there are several reasons for
okay.
that. First, I'm concerned with peace in our times that occurred in 1938 in Europe,
mm-hmm.
that appeasement and compromise is very dangerous because it gives your enemies time to solidify their resources to attack you.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I believe that it would be very much in our interest to attack Iraq because there's only dictators who have been appeasing our enemies, such as Saudi Arabia has been providing, as I understand, $200 million to Al-Qaeda so they wouldn't strike Saudi Arabia.
Not as a government, but perhaps as private citizens.
Private princes who are part of that dictatorship. Mm-hmm. And I believe that if we don't stand tall at this time, we will risk being in a situation that was worse than 9/11. I believe that 9/11 was caused in part by our failure to respond to the deaths of the Marines in Lebanon when we said we would fight and we ran. Mm-hmm. And I believe that the attacks on the embassy only emboldened our enemies. And I believe that the Europeans are not of the right mind on this, and we've come to defend them twice before. And in addition, I believe that the lesson of 9/11, the follow-up, was very profound. That is, in the streets throughout the Arab world, particularly in Pakistan, there were anti-American demonstrations. And there was great fear in the press at that time, and particularly if you watch the images on paper, on the TVs, of hundreds of thousands of Pakistanis in the street supporting Osama.
Eric, we've got your perspective. I want to put it to Joe Nye. And Joe Nye, you can hear in Eric's view, and it's a strong one, it's kind of the Donald Rumsfeld line. Everyone might not agree with us, but everyone else might be wrong. We're right, and we need to act on it. And if we don't, as Eric said, it's appeasement, and it only raises the danger that Dick Cheney today calls a mortal danger to America.
Even if we agree that we should use force to prevent Saddam Hussein from having nuclear weapons, makes a big difference how we do it. I don't think there are very many people, the people I mentioned, who are opposed to the idea of using force against Saddam to prevent him getting nuclear weapons. What they're saying is how you do it depends on whether you're going to have allies, and whether you have allies depends or determines how costly it's going to be. It's the difference between being what I call an impatient unilateral hawk and a patient multilateral hawk, and therein lies all the difference.
How big does that multilateral circle need to be enough these days? We've had India says it's profoundly opposed. China says it will veto at the Security Council level. Right now, we may have one, none, few, anyway, allies. How many do we need, not just in Washington, what kind of consensus, but what kind of, in your view, what kind of global consensus? How large a group of allies do we need to feel adequately in tune with enough of the rest of the world?
Well, in the immediate sense, in the military circle that you need, you have to have support from Turkey, from Kuwait, probably Qatar for air bases and so forth. That's going to be necessarily militarily. But for political legitimacy, I think having the British, the Germans, some of the other Europeans would make an enormous help. And I think there it does make a difference how you phrase this. If you phrase the attack on Saddam as we just want to change the regime, many of the Europeans say, hey, you want to change that one, what about the next one? And what about when the Indians want to change the Pakistani regime and so forth? If, on the other hand, you say, we think that Saddam getting hold of nuclear weapons is a threat to all of us, and he has violated his own treaties, and he's refused to allow the UN inspectors to do their duty, I think you can make this a case that he's a threat not just to us, but to others as well. And in those circumstances, I think you can get several Europeans to go along with you.
And that would be enough?
I think that's enough to make it less illegitimate. In other words, to give you that sense that there's somebody else involved who sees the world your way, not us just imposing our view.
Jack Beatty, do you see the patience in Washington to accumulate even that level of consensus?
I don't. At least you don't see the sign of it now. But, you know, the question is the president's mind on this. I mean, Ari Fleischer today said that Dick Cheney does not wander off the reservation, meaning that if Dick Cheney says something, that is the thought of George Bush. And recently, Jim Hoagland, at the beginning of the week in The Washington Post, said, you know, the president hasn't even convinced his Secretary of State. In other words, the case isn't strong enough even to have convinced Colin Powell. And Powell was quoted in another piece in The Washington Post as saying to a friend, someone said to him, you know, Secretaries of State usually meet an hour a day with the president. Don't you think you should? He said, if I met an hour a day with Bush to talk about foreign policy, what would we talk about for the other 55 minutes? The president isn't interested in foreign policy. That's our Secretary of State.
But our Secretary of State is famously, in a loop of his own at the moment, Joe Nye. Is he not? Is Colin Powell having an impact in this administration?
Well, I think there have been some issues on which the Secretary of State has prevailed, but on many he's been playing a rear guard action. It is interesting, as I said, in the last month to see the support he's received from former Secretaries of State like James Baker and Larry Eagleburger, and from former National Security Advisor like Brent Scowcroft. Essentially, he's letting them do the attack, and maybe he's waiting to run through the line after they've opened a hole. But quite clearly, the conservative side, the neoconservative side, has brought up their linebackers in the form of Cheney and Rumsfeld to plug the hole.
But as Ari Fleischer says today, Dick Cheney doesn't go off the reservation. That would suggest again that he's in tune with George Bush. What's the evidence you see, Joni, that the president himself remains undecided?
I think it's similar that people like Baker and Scowcroft, who are intense Bush senior loyalists, wouldn't go off the reservation without, for the first year of the administration, they kept their mouths totally shut. The fact that they've spoken up publicly suggests that there may be some divisions there and that the president's mind is still not totally made up.
We may have two reservations going on here. David's on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Yeah, I think, maybe you're just in the last few minutes have sort of gotten to the crux of things, because I just frankly don't understand what gives us the right to think that we can go in on this thing. I mean, to my mind, it's not a question of whether we can get allies or not to go in with us. It's what right do we have to do this? We don't have, concrete proof that we're in any mortal danger from Hussein, and as much as I hate the guy, I mean, if you look at this rationally, I mean, we have atomic weapons, we have biological weapons, we have troops all over the world. I mean, if somebody comes in and bombs us and says, geez, we want to change your regime because you have all these things going, we think that would be awful.
But David, are you saying that you're not prepared to make any moral judgment between one government and another, Saddam Hussein and another leader?
No, I'm not saying that, but what I am saying is that you do have to, buy our story and buy into who we are to believe that this is the thing to do. And I don't, frankly, trust Bush with that. I think that Bush could do this just because he thinks it would be politically advantageous. So, yes, I think you do have to make moral distinctions. But regardless, I don't think we have the right to just go in and be an aggressor because we just don't think this guy is good. I mean, we have to have real, concrete reasons to do this.
We hear you, David. Thank you for your call. Joe and I, what about this? And this goes, we're beginning to get here into your larger thesis, that the United States is walking away from many international forums, many international agreements, long-held conventions even. Are we at risk of flouting international law here in a way that's corrosive to international order, that's corrosive to our own standing in the world?
It's not only flouting international law, it's threatening our own security. One of the points that Brent Scowcroft, who's a committed hawk from years back, made in his appearance on television and in his piece in the Wall Street Journal was that we're taking attention away from al-Qaeda, which is the clear and present danger. And when you try to defeat al-Qaeda, which is a network organization with cells in 50 countries, you can't do this with the military. You can't bomb Hamburg or Kuala Lumpur, or now we discover Detroit, because there's an al-Qaeda cell there.
We can't even bomb Osama bin Laden,
bomb him. And essentially, the only way you're going to defeat al-Qaeda is through close civilian cooperation, intelligence sharing, police work across borders, cooperation among customs officials, tracing financial flows. And that type of cooperation depends on others being willing to work with us. And so if we antagonize the others, alienate them so they're less willing to work with us, we're actually making our own security worse.
If that's the case, then what do you think is the internal rationale of the Bush administration officials who clearly, strongly, deeply favor war on Iraq? Why?
Well, if you take various pronouncements of Richard Perle, who's the head of the Defense Policy Board, he argues that if we get rid of Saddam, that will take care of other problems. Our reputation in the Middle East will go up because we've gotten rid of him. There's a cliche, the Wall Street Journal often puts it, that the road to Jerusalem goes through Baghdad. In other words, if you get rid of Saddam Hussein, then you'll be able to get settlement in the Arab-Israeli dispute. There's a feeling that somehow Saddam is the stumbling block. if you think that Saddam is evil and that indeed we should not let him get nuclear weapons, which I do think, but he is not as clear and present a danger as al-Qaeda, and you also think that to get rid of Saddam you have to prepare the way so you don't wind up doing it alone, so that you have both the military support and political legitimacy, then you essentially focus first on al-Qaeda, and then you prepare the ground for proving to other countries that Saddam is a threat to them as well as to us.
Tim's calling from Woodstock, Illinois. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Thank you for accepting my call.
Good to have you.
I want to just address a principle. I'm not sold on a war with Iraq. I just want to be upfront with that. But I do and would like to argue that I believe that we as America, as a sovereign nation, need to look at our own interests. And sometimes that is in contrast to our political allies on the international level. I think that we need to evaluate this far more, but I think that even though, for example, Europe, who depends far more on their oil than we do, they're going to have their own particular interests.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that we should go to war. I'm saying principally.
That in principle, we should be prepared to make our own evaluation and decision.
That is correct.
Let me put that to Joe Nye, Tim, and thank you for your call. Joe Nye, what about it? Can we decide and act? What if the view is that Europe is just wimpy, dishonest, cowardly? It's not willing to face up to a real problem.
Well, we should decide in our own interest, but how we define our interests can either be broad and long run, or it can be short and narrow. I think when we think in the broad and long run, we realize that we have a strong interest in maintaining a relationship with Europe. This is the part of the world where we have the closest similarity of values. The last thing we want to do is alienate them and be alone. In the long run, the fact that the Europeans and the Americans share basic values is extremely important to us and our place in the world. And as for the oil issue, let me tell you, if there's an oil disruption, the price of oil in the United States and the price of oil in Europe are going to be the same, very high.
Can you imagine a situation in which we, in fact, are alienated and alone without Europe in this century?
I would hope that that doesn't occur. On the other hand, if I look at how much antagonism has arisen in the European-American relationship in the last 12 months, it's much greater than I expected.
Listeners, we're talking tonight with Joe Nye, Dean at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, about America, the unilateral, making war, maybe making war alone. Is our strength in following our own instincts, wielding our own sword, or working with others? Are we wiser in alliance or wiser alone? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America, the unilateral, preparing perhaps to go to war, even if alone, with Iraq. Our guest tonight is Joseph Nye. He's a former senior defense and intelligence official in the Clinton administration, dean at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and author of The Paradox of American Power, Why the World's Only Superpower Can't Go It Alone. You are welcome as well. If the whole world says no to war with Iraq, does it matter? Should we jump in anyway? Are we ultimately more powerful alone or with others? And can we afford to make war and enforce peace in Iraq alone? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Charles is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Thanks for taking
my call.
Sure.
I had a real simple question, I guess. It always seems to me that the United States has always taken the part of a conflict has started and has come in to help out. This time, it kind of seems like the United States is being the aggressor in the whole scheme of things. Is there an instance that happened in the past? Is there a history that the United States has been in that position before?
Jack Beatty, let me turn this one to you. We all read about President Bush's speech talking about a unilaterally determined preemptive self-defense and justifying that. What's the historical record here?
Well, off the top of my head, some people look at the Mexican War, for example, and they say that President Polk, put it this way, went the last mile to provoke war with Mexico. He sent troops into an area that was in dispute between the two countries. Was this Texas or was this Mexico? And that was under negotiation, and they got shot at. And American blood on American soil. Well, in Congress, Lincoln challenged that. He was a young congressman. He said, "How do we know it was American soil? Can you show us?"
So not fully preemptive action, but as near as can be.
As near as can be. He provoked the war in order to take California. I mean, this country has grown by war. We can't blink our history in that respect.
Joe Nye, what do you say to Charles' question? Are we pushing into new ground here, or is this a posture with precedent?
Well, another case for history would be the Spanish-American War, which you can make a case that we helped to at least provoke. But I think in more recent history, the important thing is during the Cold War, we could rely on deterrence and wait. I mean, we had when the Soviet Union had nuclear weapons, but they were very cautious, and you could count on deterring them. I think the question that President Bush has properly raised is what happens when you have somebody like Saddam Hussein, who is a proven risk taker, a major risk taker, who may feel that he has nothing to lose. What happens if he gets nuclear weapons? Will they stay in his hands? Will they leak into the hands of terrorists? Can we afford to wait? So I think there is a case that the president has made that just to say we can contain him and deter him as we did the Soviets may be too high a risk for us to take. So I'm sympathetic to that point. But I think we have to convince other people of that as well. We can't be the sole judge and jury and still have the good opinions of others.
Mm-hmm. And we should point out, you yourself, Joe Nye, are no Wilsonian idealist. You, a dozen years ago, wrote Bound to Lead.
Right.
You said America's going to have power come to it. That's just the way it is. But is it possible that the United States, that George Bush in his new policy of preventive warfare is just ahead of the curve, that the rest of the world hasn't caught up with the meaning of an age of terrorism, that the hawks have it right?
Well, there's a difference between preventive and preemptive. Preventive means if there's some danger, you go ahead and attack. Preemptive means when it's a clear and present danger, you attack. That makes a huge difference. If there's a clear and present danger, it's imminent, then I think most people would say that it's right to attack. If it's preventive, there's one chance in 1,000 that he may be a problem to us sometime in the future, I don't think many people would say that that's justified.
Do you believe that the evidence is out there to clearly define this as preventive?
I think that if we go back with the UN inspection system, and we show that he is not willing to let the inspections occur, if we have the evidence that he is developing nuclear weapons, I think we can make the case that since this is a man who's violated his own treaties not to develop nuclear weapons, who has used chemical weapons against his own population, I think you make the case that you can't allow him to go ahead and get these weapons.
At this point, Baghdad, always savvy about what's going on in the rest of the world, is not showing any willingness to open up to those inspections. A vice president in Iraq said today he said, quote, "The U.S. administration is an insane criminal administration. Its logic is the logic of force. We're not going to open up to inspections. If Iraq digs in its heels and we don't have any more evidence than we have now, that would seem to leave us at a kind of a dead end."
Well, I think you have to go through that effort to get the inspectors in there. If he continually resists or if he lets them in, what sometimes been called cheat and retreat, then you have to make sure it's full and unfettered inspection. And if he stops them going where they want, that's the point in which you say this is the proof we need.
Tom is on the line. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Oh, how are you doing tonight?
Well.
Well, my comment is about I think we can go alone. I think it is possible. We did go in Baghdad in the Desert Storm. We should have. Now we got to go take care of the job again. You know, we could have had this done. What needs to happen is
But Tom, it was our own restraint, really, in the Gulf War that kept us from going into Baghdad. Nobody else stopped us.
There was a lot of political resistance too from Europe, and basically we said we were going to free Kuwait. And now Korea was free, and we didn't go in there because that's what our job was to do.
Right. We'd finished the one.
We have a lot of political and financial clout in this world, and we don't need that many people because they understand if they don't help us, what will happen.
Well, there we go. Tom, thanks for that. And this goes, Joe and I, right to your central thesis. Tom is correct. We have a lot of political and certainly a lot of economic clout. But is that all that matters these days? Describe to us your kind of three-tier view of what clout is and how we've been exercising it since 9/11.
Yeah, if you think of power today as like a three-dimensional chess game, the top board, the military board, as one that we control. Nobody's going to replace us on that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to the middle board of this game, the economic board, this isn't one which the United States controls. We want a trade agreement or something like that. We want antitrust rules. We have to get the Europeans and the Japanese and others to agree with us. If you go to the bottom board of transnational relations, of things that cross borders outside the control of government.
You call this soft power.
Yeah, which is also where the terrorist part comes in. You're going to find that you have to have cooperation with others. Nobody's in control of that area. And that's where you need your soft power. You need others to be attracted to you, to be willing to cooperate with you. It's the point I made earlier. You can't bomb Hamburg or Detroit because there's an al-Qaeda cell there. You got to get others to cooperate with you to wrap them up.
I've just got to ask you, you were clearly working on this book well before 9/11. Since 9/11, a force of arms has been so much front and center in U.S. foreign policy. Is this your nightmare scenario? Do you see us walking away from the other tiers of power beyond brute force?
Well, my nightmare is that we play a three-dimensional game on one board only. And if you're playing three-dimensional chess and you focus on one board, you're going to lose. You got to concentrate on all three boards.
Can the United States lose the hyperpower, the superpower?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at what happened to Rome, it wasn't defeated by the rise of another empire. It was defeated by the barbarians. To me, the terrorists are the new barbarians.
Are you suggesting the terrorists defeating the United States?
Not defeating
it. Fill in that picture a
little. Not defeating it, but really destroying the quality of life of our civilization. Imagine terrorists getting hold of weapons of mass destruction and using them in our cities. After a nuclear weapon goes off in downtown Boston or New York or
Chicago, you name it,
guess what's going to happen to property prices? Guess what's going to happen to insurance rates? Guess what's going to happen to museums, theaters, and so forth? We're going to change the quality of life in this civilization dramatically. There was still a Rome after the barbarians took over, but it wasn't the same Rome. We have absolutely got to deal with terrorism, and we can't do it alone. We've got to get cooperation.
That would then describe going it alone in Iraq as perhaps an instance where we could win the battle but still lose the larger war.
Well, if it led to a situation where others were less willing to cooperate with us, that would be true.
Jack Beatty, those are huge stakes that Joe Nye is describing.
They really are. I mean, and he speaks really out of the tradition of American foreign policy, and I think we have to step back here and look at the character, the political character of the president's advisors, and we won't go any further than Donald Rumsfeld. I mean, he was a Goldwater Republican in the 1960s. He tried to subvert the nomination of Paul Nitzer, who was a hawk of the hawks, as President Kennedy's assistant secretary, as deputy secretary of defense, by feeding information about some speech he made someplace to Barry Goldwater. When he was secretary of defense the last time in 1976, while Henry Kissinger was in Moscow negotiating a SALT missile limitation agreement, Rumsfeld was getting Gerry Ford's ear and saying, look, we can't possibly do this. And he was calling in the National Security Council to veto in advance anything that Kissinger negotiated. Well, you know, Carter's people think that that's when Gerry Ford lost that election. That Gerry Ford could have gone to the people in 1976 and said, I've got a missile agreement with the Soviets. Don Rumsfeld said no.
And now he's Secretary of Defense at a time when we're considering war and are really reconsidering imagining our relationship with the whole world.
Yes, and his dream, and you know, you got to step back from our own feelings about the country. They're breaking out of the ABM treaty. So what do we have here? I mean, if you're China looking at us, what do you see? You see a kind of rampant power that's going to neutralize the power of your missiles with its shield and then intervene wherever it wants. You know, the ABM thing isn't just defense. It's offense. It's a shield that allows you to strike with impunity. And this is scary. These people on the right, these Rumsfeld, Pearl, Wolfowitz, they have wanted this kind of flexibility even when there was a Soviet Union. They wanted to neutralize the nuclear threat so that we could intervene wherever we wanted. This is a long-term ambition. Now they have power, and who knows what they could do with it.
Joe Nye, do you agree that we've got these personalities and worldview closer to the rudder of American foreign policy and power than they've been in a long time?
Well, clearly there are two hands that are tugging at this rudder. There's the traditional Republican hand, and there's the neoconservative hand, and the boat sometimes gets jerked back and forth. Look at the inconsistencies on our Middle East policy as different hands have tugged on the rudder.
But the neoconservatives seem much more in office and in power and closer to power than Scowcroft and Baker coming, you know, singing in from retirement.
I think that's right. I mean, the fact that Vice President Cheney forms an alliance from inside the White House with Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld gives him an extra hand.
What about the very simple, most basic alliances you described early in the hour that you say would be required militarily to prevail, even if we just look at Iraq, Turkey, Kuwait, Qatar? Do you think they'll line up? Will they be there? Or could we see even those three fall out of the equation?
I think they'll probably line up, but it's not a sure thing. I was just looking at a recent Gallup poll on attitudes in Kuwait. And it was striking to me how anti-American and mistrustful Kuwaiti attitudes were about the United States. This is the country we saved a decade ago.
If George Bush is still straddling, as you speculate he may be, describe for us a path by which the president could retreat from the war path that he has so far put the country on.
I think the president ought to stop the rhetoric about regime change, focus clearly on Saddam getting weapons of mass destruction, go through the efforts to use the UN system, the existing UN resolutions, to show that Saddam is not willing to play the game, and gradually build support, even if it's not a large coalition, it'll be some coalition, to prepare the grounds for when we get pretty good evidence that Saddam is developing nuclear weapons, we'll have a way to use force with others supporting us. I think that's still doable.
And that would be a different world. Joseph Nye, it's been great having you with us tonight. Thank you so much for coming in. Joe Nye is dean at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of The Paradox of American Power, Why the World's Only Superpower Can't Go It Alone. Jack Beatty, can you imagine George W. Bush putting this big engine in reverse at this point?
Well, I think his neoconservatives have tried to stake him out. I mean, Pearl has come out and said the president can't retreat now. Certainly he can. Presidents do that all the time, and from foolish statements and from statements made by foolish advisors who weren't elected by anybody.
Of course, as Joe Nye describes the path forward, after this UN inspection or whatever efforts made there, it could still come around to war with Iraq.
It could, but in a very different context where the world, where there'd be a clear casus belli. They didn't let the inspectors in, that violating the agreement, join us Europe, join us Japan, different picture entirely.
That might be a different world. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.